Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. Welcome to podcast number 90, the beginning of a new year, beginning of 2016. My guest today is producer, songwriter, musician, and manager, Walter Turbitt. But first, something interesting happened on Christmas Eve, and that's the Beatles began to stream. On 9 different services, you can now find most of the Beatles albums. You can't find the ones in mono, you can't find the special releases, but most of their albums are certainly available right now. And that's interesting because they were one of the few holdouts from streaming. The other ones, of course, are Garth Brooks, Prince, and Bob Seger, where you won't find anywhere online except for YouTube, and those aren't by choice. That's mostly user-generated. Adele, of course, and Taylor Swift say they're not streaming, but really, you can find them on Apple Music, and you can find them on Tidal. Where you can't find them is the services like Spotify that have freemium tiers. But nonetheless, you still can find those artists. It's the legacy artist. And once upon a time, Pink Floyd was one of those artists as well. But they gave in last year. So now what this signifies is the fact that streaming is pretty mainstream. When you have the last holdout saying that, wait a second, we should probably be doing this because it's good for our brand and we can actually make money. And I think it actually signifies that streaming is here to stay. When you find the holdouts are no longer holding out, it just goes to show you that, in fact, everyone has jumped on board here. Now, it's interesting that the Beatles had some big numbers. They weren't huge, but they were big. There were 50 million streams in the first 48 hours. And on Spotify, there were 300,000 the first day, as well as an ad to 600,000 playlists. The interesting thing is, most of these streams were from people that were under age 34, 65%. Now, you might think that 300,000 is a lot, and it is, but to put it in perspective, Justin Bieber holds the record for 1 million streams in a 24-hour period. So, in fact, we can see that the Beatles are popular. They're not as popular as contemporary artists, but that being said, they'll probably stream and make more over the long haul. Now, what were the biggest songs that were streamed? Well, Come Together was number 1, Let It Be was number 2, and Hey Jude is number 3. Now, I think this was actually a missed opportunity because what could have happened is the Beatles could have said to all the different streaming networks, you can have our music except for the fact that it has to be on the premium tier and it can't be on the free tier. That would have forced some people who wanted to hear that music to pay for the music on the premium tier. So it actually would have been good for all of the streaming platforms in general to get more subscribers. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is the Beatles got a special deal that nobody else got. So in other words, they're making a much higher royalty rate. We don't know what it is. We just know that it's a higher royalty rate. So Beatles coming to streaming, it's actually a landmark, although a minor one. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 mixing tricks, big studio tricks for the small studio, and now it's available by the module. So there's 5 modules. You can buy each of them separately or all together. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Now we want to talk about the neuroscience of drumming. It's interesting in that through the years, drummers weren't considered musicians in many cases. Jazz musicians, for instance, kind of looked down upon drummers. And many times the perception is that drummers are perhaps maybe the least intelligent of everybody on stage. However, there's been a couple studies that have found out that's far from the truth. There is one Swedish study that found that there was a definite link between good timing and problem solving and intelligence. And basically equated drummers, especially drummers with a high degree of proficiency, to very intelligent people. There's also another study done by Baylor scientist David Engelman and producer Eno that found out that drummers have different brains. And what happens is they perceive timing in a different way. In fact, most drummers will listen to the timing of nature, where most other musicians and people that aren't musicians don't hear that timing. Don't listen to those intervals. And one more thing they found out is drumming releases endorphins. Drummers get a high, kind of like runner's high. Drumming is also good in therapy because of that. It makes you feel good. So it behooves everybody to treat their drummer Right, because they deserve it. A great drummer is not only worthy of your respect because of his ability, but also because of his intelligence. My guest today is my longtime friend, Walter Turbitt. Walt and I had a production company together way back when we were first starting out, so I know him as a gifted musician, a songwriter, producer, and an engineer. Lately, though, he's shifted gears into managing DJs and EDM artists, so I was really interested in hearing the inside scoop about that world. I spoke with Walter via phone in Los Angeles, where he was in the middle of a session. I know you as a rock dude. I know you as a great guitar player, as a songwriter, as a great producer, as an engineer. I don't know you as a manager. So tell me how you made that transition into being a manager.
Well, I was working in England, as we've talked about before. You know, most of my career was as a songwriter and a producer. And I went to Nashville with a company I was working with, was there for a few years, and then moved to LA, and I was running a publishing company and also still producing and writing songs. And it's kind of a long story, but one of my assistants I had hired had a husband who was working with these DJs, and this was 5 years ago, so it was still pre the big EDM boom. And well, you know what it's like in the music business today. If you're not writing for Beyonce or work with Taylor Swift, it's really hard to get songs covered or produced. So, you know, I was looking for new things, and I had a meeting with these guys, and they were stars when I met them. And, you know, I just started to get into the local scene, and because they were working for a little bit of money around town, and they had built up a following. And one thing led to another. And, you know, when I was at Wright Bank, I started getting them work in Vegas, which has turned out to be the mecca of EDM music. And still is, though it's changing drastically. And, you know, I've been around management and everything my whole life, which goes along with the territory. And it just kind of went sideways into it. And had a really good run the last 4 or 5 years. Things are changing now. But there you go.
Well, isn't the mindset way different, though? Because what's happening is you're subjugating your creativity for someone else's, aren't you?
You know the diversity in when you call the producer who actually does what. So I'm used to doing whatever has to be done. And, you know, as we talked about before, I am getting back in creatively, but there's creativity in everything you do. So I guess the biggest thing going into EDM and managing another act, I guess I found the creativity in the art of the deal, the negotiations, the business side of things. You know, I kind of grew to like some of the EDM music, though I'm sure we'll get to in a bit the changing scene of it. So the creative aspect of the musical side of EDM took some getting used to, because I am a song guy and I still am a song guy. I love writing songs, which I'm doing again now. So when EDM started to break, there was a formula and it was alien to me. And I've learned about all the different genres. There's probably 20 subgenres under what people would call EDM or house or deep house or tropical house or progressive, whatever you want to talk about. So, you know, I've learned a lot about a different side of music that I didn't really know about before.
What would you say the biggest difference is in EDM from what you're doing before?
Musically?
Yeah.
Well, when I started, I've always been a song guy with lyrics and melody being the forefront of my interest and what drove me. And then opened up my mind to the whole rest of the world who, EDM 5 years ago, there were very little lyrics. And it was just about the music, the festivals, you know, 10, 20,000 people just nodding their heads and bumping up and down to what seemed to be an incessantly long 4 bars of music. So that took a little bit getting used to, but at the end of the day, it's each his own. And is, you know, how music has changed over the years. It's all about audience and the size of an audience. And there's a huge audience out there for people who look at pop music as cheesy. And I've had many, many conversations with clients through the last 4 or 5 years that pop just means popular. So if there's a genre of music that doesn't have vocals and choruses and what I've always loved, it just depends on the size of that audience. And I've learned there's huge audiences in all these different genres. So the biggest difference was how to not be able to tap into a song and to find out. I've always been curious about what the public, what motivates the public and the listener. And I started to try to analyze the EDM music and you know, what people were being attracted to.
Okay, so what is that?
Well, I mean, you know, people used to bring up the drug culture. And yes, there is that hypnotic drone. There's something about 20,000 people and extremely great production value and loud music feeling a bond. I guess it's the hypnoticness of the feeling. And actually, interestingly enough, I went to a singer I'm working with now had done a song with an artist called Vice Tone, and there was a drum and bass concert, and it was an 18 plus show, so or an all ages show, so there's a lot of younger kids there. And the artist I'm working with, who's one of my clients, Dorigo, is trying to tell me that even when he was younger, it's like a revolution where they revolt against pop music and that kind of culture. And these kids were going nuts to really, literally, just two bars of the same non-melody driven, distorted bass line, very sparse, almost tribal music. And, you know, I hate it myself, but I have to appreciate the fact that a generation or a large group of people are digging it and, you know, really getting off on it. So I guess it's hard. You know, like, why do I love the Beatles and not the Rolling Stones so much? You know, I mean, I love the Rolling Stones, but I was always a Beatles guy. So you have to try to understand what other people like. I mean, I've always been open to all kinds of music, and I try to find creativity in anything. So, and I do think that whether I don't personally like a genre of music or not, there must be something in it. And I've always said this. If a million people like something, they're not wrong. You can't say it's not good. You just can't. You can only say it's not for me. So I'm still trying to learn more about that. But it's a culture. It's almost a revolution culture against pop music or, you know, commercial music, which has been there since the beginning of time. But this whole underground, what used to be underground, because it's evolved into now it's pop music with Calvin Harris and Zedd and David Guetta crossing over, you know, then our pop records. So that's causing another change in the industry.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to mention that and the fact that EDM has influenced pop music so much that when you listen to any kind of pop, it's undeniable that EDM influence is there. And of course, when you have producers who are basically DJs or EDM artists and are producing those records, then, you know, you have that inevitable crossover, so to speak. I guess it's a crossover, it's a evolution, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when you're in this scene, there is a big difference between a DJ and a producer. And the whole controversy over ghost producers, you know, the phenomenon itself that a guy stands up and puts his fucking hands in the air, which is the saying that is now being challenged. What's he really doing? Most of these DJs are playing other people's music. The very successful ones who make, like Calvin Harris makes $400,000 for a 2-hour show in Vegas. And Skrillex, who I've seen in very, very talented. Those kinds of guys, it's a strange phenomenon when most of the other DJs who actually don't make the music are just playing other people's music. And in a simple way, what I've learned is people just want to have a good time. You know, we've had residencies with my bigger clients in Vegas, and they travel the world and in other countries, and the shows that I've gone to, people just want to have a good time. And that's, I think, the commercial side of EDM. That's as simple as it is.
I certainly get that. But now what you're describing is a live phenomena versus a recorded phenomena. So when you
exactly. At the end of the day, most of the DJs and EDM people will tell you, no one makes any money from physical or download sales of traditional EDM music. Those records are out there in labels like Spinning and the whole Beatport platform are there to drive up their live fees. Now, when you've got a Calvin Harris who does a track with Rihanna and becomes pop music, that's a totally different ballgame. I say this all the time. Calvin Harris could walk down the street before he was Taylor Swift's boyfriend. Nobody would know who he is. And he made $68 million last year, the number one DJ in the world. But he's anonymous. But he needs a real producer in that sense. But that those hits in the commercial side have driven his fees up to $400,000 plus. You still have Hardwells and Tiestos and long and tested and tried DJs who make that same amount of money or close to it for festivals all around the world that a pop culture like my 13-year-old daughter have no idea about. Huge amounts of money. And that's driven, I don't think that the kids are buying the music because what it takes to have a hit on Beatport, sorry, this plane going over, they're not selling millions of records or millions and millions of downloads, but the people stream those EDM records or see them in live performances from other DJs and other clubs and become familiar with the tracks and then want to see and experience the live phenomenon of feeling part of that event. It's not the music so much that you're going to listen to in your headphones or in your car, as opposed to going to see it live and having the decibel level to support the feeling with the music.
See, what you're describing is one of the tenets of one of my books, Music 4.0. And the whole thing that I keep on saying is, we're writing, is that at least today, and probably it was always like this to some degree, your music is your marketing. And that's exactly what you're describing, where your recorded music is your marketing, and it's marketing you to get bigger for live performances.
Right. Well, we both know, music in this McDonald's disposable society and the attention span of the average listener of maybe 20 seconds, if you're lucky, there's so much to grab a person's attention these days that, music has become a business card. The days of you'd buy a record and get a T-shirt for free, it's reversed. They'll give away the music and you buy a T-shirt, and that's how they make money. It's totally evolved.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned about how EDM is changing and the scene is changing. How so?
Well, to coin that phrase of "put your fucking hands up," which is what EDM was known for years. I started to say a couple of years ago, how long can you keep your fucking hands up? And that's what's happened. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I actually said to one of my clients, why don't you write a track called "Put Your Fucking Hands Down"? I always believe that you've got to do the opposite and do something different. But that culture of, there's a thing called bottle service where all these DJs who play Vegas, and I think they've realized, hey, I don't really need to spend $50,000 to have a bunch of pretty girls around me.
Yeah.
So that's kind of changed. And like anything, it has to evolve. And I've seen a big backlash against it, what's called the banger music, the typical big room music, because you can only play Clarity and Titanium, and those, I think those are great songs, for so many times. But then again, the shows that I go to, when they play those tracks, people still go crazy. Hip hop was so big for so long that that's coming back. But everything I think picks up a little bit of each element and evolves into the next thing. So fundamentally, EDM is changing because people are just tired of the same stuff, which happens in every generation. And there's a thing called deep house, which I personally generally don't admire, or I'm not in touch with, but that's a total backlash to the big room bangers. It's moodier and it's mellower, but it's not going to work in a Vegas club atmosphere. So it's still in a transition area, and I'm happy to see the Calvins and Skrillex and Diplo working with Justin Bieber, which the purest EDM people think is a sellout. But those records, they're unique, they're different, and you, like I said, you can't deny them. Now, my 13-year-old is a huge Justin Bieber fan, largely because of the influence that's happening with some of the EDM DJs. So yet again, and Madonna having Diplo produce on her album, we both know, marketing genius. So yeah, it is evolving. Fundamentally, I think the crowd and the audience has just gotten bored with the same old put your fucking hands up. Simple as that.
Where is it going?
Well, it's already started going in the popular format. And like we talked about, the influence of EDM affecting pop music. So that's one area it's going. At the same time, the revolt against that and the underground EDM with the deep house and all the variations of house is gaining a larger traction because people are going back to some of those roots. And those are always the diehard fans who never liked commercial music and never will. So I think though it's evolving into a pop arena, it's still carving out its own niche. You're not going to take the people from all the underground genres, and just because Calvin Harris is selling millions and millions of records with major pop artists, they're not going to like it. So that audience is going further the other way. What's happened is the EDM commercial popular music is gaining the younger audience from the commercial songs with Zed working with Selena Gomez and artists like that. So I don't know if I knew exactly where it was going, and then, you know, I'd be a genius, but I can see where it's heading. And the good thing for me is I'm happy whenever it goes into an arena of talent and great singers and great songwriters. I love trying to keep up with the times and new styles of production. And, you know, like we talked to at another point in time, I'm back into programming on Cubase, and I've used Pro Tools and Logic and Ableton. And Ableton is the DJ's choice of DAW, but I find it so limiting and it's so uninspiring for me. But most DJs use that platform, and it's terrible, in my opinion, for vocals, because vocals were never part of that EDM music. So I'll let you know when I crack it exactly where it's going, but it's evolving.
All right, so let's talk about EDM production techniques. You're used to recording, well, like probably the majority of listeners here, they're recording live music, real drums. It's a different mindset in EDM. Where are you coming from?
It sure is. I would have to say, and I have these battles all the time with the quote-unquote younger generation who's grown up in with EDM and Ableton and music schools or whatever. They are so technically oriented, they miss out on what music's all about, which is feel, heart, whatever that X factor is. Yeah, in this instance, working with some of these younger producers, the first thing they'll do is throw up an analyzer on a track. And then go try to notch this and do that, whatever. And I'm like, what does it sound like? You know, before you go to the analyzer, if you need to fix something or carve something out, fine. But what does it sound like? And I tell them, if I'm listening to a mix or whatever, I don't want to know. Don't tell me what you're doing. Let me listen to it. Does it have something? Does it have a feel? Does it move me? You know, and they're so... Yeah, but you don't understand. No, I've notched the kick drum and I've added another one. I've done the sub here and I've bounced that. And I'm like, yeah, but it sounds like shit. I'm not feeling anything. So that's the fundamental difference, I would think, in production style. At the end of the day, whatever you do production style wise, whether it's adding a live instrument, which is happening more and more now, you still have to be able to play it to somebody. And I always use the analogy of play it to your girlfriend or play it to somebody who does not know what a compressor is. And they have to smile or want to get up and dance or whatever the genre music it is that you're making. You have to reach that listener who does not use their brain in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but I do play my daughter a lot of stuff. And she tells me right away, love it, hate it. And they just did a song with this artist, Kat, who's a phenomenal singer. And she loved the song until it got to the EDM part. And she hated it. So, you know, and you don't need explanations. It's, you've got to, and I hope to God this never goes away, you've got to reach somebody. You've got to touch somebody with something. So if you want to get more into specific production styles, that's a fundamental difference that I have absolutely come up against all the time. Another client of mine will say, well, we changed the the pads, or we did this, and I'm like, yeah, but the song still sucks. I don't care what you're changing the pads to. You know, so you can change the pads all day long, but if you don't have a great song or a great hook, whether it's a vocal or a melody hook, an instrumental, whatever, if you don't have that, the sound of the pad doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, you know, it's the same old thing, really.
Yeah,
I always felt that no matter what the song is, if it's a hit, you've captured some sort of magic, and you kind of have
That's
to appreciate
that.
You have to appreciate it for what it is. You might not like the artist, you might not like the presentation or the genre, but you have to appreciate the fact that you captured that lightning in a bottle. But, you know, if it was so easy, everybody would do it, except for Max Martin, who tends to do it all the time, but everybody else is kind of human.
Yeah, it must be pretty easy for him. But, Bobby, I say the same thing to everybody. You know, if it was easy, then everybody would do it. And I think, and what I've hopefully taught some of the people that I work with is what magic is. How do you define it? And I tell them, if you can analyze it, it's no good. You know, you can't analyze what's going to be a hit or why something moves somebody. And that's what I was saying earlier. Most of these younger producer types really think it's the sound of the kick drum. And no, it isn't. It's much more than that. And you have to be able to respect the magic and the quest for it. And, you know, that's something that I think if you realize that, you learn that in whatever genre of music you make, you're way ahead of the game.
You know, I see the same thing as well. It seems like the less sophisticated or less experienced engineers of any type these days are making everything so difficult on themselves. Like you say, instead of listening to what they have, they tend to load plugins up and layer part after part after part, and you go, well, wait. You know, you didn't have to do that.
I've seen some sessions where I'll look at the channel strip, and they've got 8 EQs on it, and I'm like, oh my god, if you can't get it done with 1 or 2 EQs, what the hell are you 8 EQs? And I think, sadly. And you and I, you know, we have a history together of making music, and that's another conversation. But growing up in the days of 24 tracks or even 8 tracks way back or whatever, you know, if you have 127 tracks and you get an idea today, let me add a shaker in this part or whatever, you just do it. But when the days of making music, when you had to decide, am I going to bounce that with the bass track to have some kind of separation, or do I really need that part because they don't have it? That forces you to think about, is that part necessary? And because of this unlimited flexibility of manipulating anything you want, I mean, and I can make anybody sound good singing wise, except myself, it teaches you a discipline about what really matters and what's really necessary. And I see these channel strips, oh my God, and there's 5 mastering plugins, and there's just, and now add another EQ to add, and then, It you know what's hilarious? If you take all that stuff off and just make the fader louder, it sounds the exact same.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, you got to learn. You got to do what you got to do.
You know, you were mentioning before about playing songs for your daughter and for, you know, fans and stuff like that. I just had a situation like that where I was producing and mixing a track, and they always audition it with their girlfriends and wives, which, you know, is pretty good. But I got some feedback about a guitar solo. Well, the one girlfriend didn't like the guitar solo. And
why?
Oh, it didn't move her.
Because it was, let me guess, because it wasn't on a 57 Strat with a wah-wah?
It didn't get that sophisticated. No, it just didn't make her move. And of course, there were like 27 takes, so it was comped together.
Yeah.
So I did another comp. And this one, it was acceptable to her. And
well, that's really interesting. What was it about the new comp that reached her?
It was a little more aggressive, and
it wasn't
as smooth, but it was more aggressive. But the interesting,
right.
I got to say, when I first heard that, I went, "Oh, are you kidding?" And, you know, I have to do this again. But the day they released it, it went to number 5 on iTunes. So
wow. Now, did you like the new comp better?
I didn't like it, but I thought it was different. I didn't think it was necessarily better. It was different. But
the
point of it is, I don't know if that had anything to do with the acceptability, when it finally was released or not. But you have to appreciate someone who's not a musician, you have to appreciate, and who is a fan, actually, you kind of have to appreciate their point of view. And it's
absolutely
really easy to overlook that sometimes, or just, you know, negate it completely and say,
Well, that's what I always try to do that. And I like to think that I humbly have, or I try to maintain that objectivity. I mean, I think that's the hardest thing in making music is objectivity, because we know how things work. And once you know how something works, it's very hard to forget about that. I particularly seem to like what a large portion of the public likes, and I genuinely like it. I always tell people, you can't write a hit if you don't like it. I don't believe you can, because you are the messenger for the music that you make. So if you're not enjoying it, you don't believe in it, you don't like it, the people that you're going to play it to will pick up on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I believe that. But and that the story you just told backs up the argument that nobody knows. Nobody knows. You know, would that record still have been number five or maybe number four with the old guitar solo?
Right.
You just have to make music.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're right. Who knows when it's all said and done? The only thing I can say to that is I remember in the 80s when you had Frankie Goes to Hollywood. I was in England, I remember. And Frankie Goes to Hollywood came out with five different versions of the same single, whatever it was. It wasn't Relax. It was the one after it.
Right.
Each one was a little different. They're different remixes. And you go, well, why? Why are you doing this? But on the other hand, there was something interesting in each single one of them that must have spoken to a different crowd or different subgenre, so to speak, that actually made it interesting. And in retrospect, I look back at that and I think, you know, that was actually kind of cool that you would go to that extent to make multiple mixes and put out. Today, we'd say that was great, because what you're doing is you're supplying more content to your fans. So, and it would be applauded. But back then it was kind of a groundbreaking, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what was interesting. With one of the clients that I'm working with, the other night, they said, well, play me some of the stuff that, you know, from your generation, whatever, that you like. So I played Seal's Crazy, blew them away. And one of my DJs said, my God, that the production of that record, Trevor Horn, one of my idols in Mutt Lange, the production of that record not only sounds current, it still sounds future. And I played Annie Lennox's Why and Peter Gabriel with Kate Bush. And they're just blown away. This is way before auto-tune, some quantizing, I guess, to some extent. But the look on their faces was comforting to go, oh, my God, they can sing. They can perform. And it sounds amazing. It was really cool, actually.
You know what's cool about Trevor Horn? And I've had a couple of people who've worked with him on the show, and I've interviewed him from books. Apparently, all of the magic happened in recording. And yet, when you listen to those mixes, you think, wow, everything is layered and everything. But in fact, they would record all the effects. And a lot of times, one of the engineers told me that they would leave the assistants to do basically the mix because it was pretty much done. It mixed itself. And, you know, they didn't think much about it. And the mix was the least important of everything they were doing. But it doesn't sound that way, you know, to me anyway. You know what I mean? It just sounds big and layered, and you think, wow, they must have spent weeks on this. And it wasn't the case at all.
Yep. Well, yeah, they mixed as they, well, I did too. We kind of mixed as we went along. And that's part of what I was talking about earlier, is that, you know, there's a tendency to just throw another track, we'll get to it later or whatever. It's the process of making the music as you're building the track that you have to have a vision as you're going along. You can't just leave it till the end and then try to create something magical that was never there in the first place.
That's one of the things that all mixers that I speak to complain about, that they're getting 100 plus tracks in, and a lot of them are duplicates, or, you know, it's doubles, triples, whatever, where one would have done or two would have done. And they're just ideas that are put on, and they leave it to the mixer to sort out. And it makes them crazy because it's like, well, okay, what do I use? What don't I use? And do I have to go and listen to every single one of these, you know? So,
yes, you do, because I think a mixer in that capacity is actually the producer.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, they're responsible for the outcome of that record. Absolutely.
So anyway, coming back again, what's hot right now in your world? What's the thing that's really happening?
You mean in general?
Yeah.
Well, where I'm trying to head, and the people that I'm working with, the artists I mentioned earlier, I'm trying to take the clients that I have that I work with who have EDM experience and capitalize and transition into the pop world, like Skrillex and Diplo and Calvin Harris and those producers are doing. So, I mean, in my world, that's what's hot because it is getting back to songs. EDM influenced production, which is the natural evolution of sound, but with really good songs and hooks. Like I've always said, I'm a hook guy. I just happen to like hooky things.
And, I think most people do actually.
When you play somebody a song, when you play someone a song, I know what they're going to be singing when they walk out of the room.
Yeah.
And if they're not singing it, I got to go back to the drawing board.
Well, again, with straight EDM, do you have that people singing?
No, I'm trying to get away from straight EDM.
Yeah.
So, luckily, I'm working with people now who appreciate where we think it's going, which is more song oriented. So I'm able to satisfy and help develop the songs because I've always been more of a craftsman, though I do write and I love writing lyrics too. I never thought I would in the past. I think, when I spent a couple of years in Nashville, I learned what a songwriter was. That's a special talent. One of my first sessions I did in Nashville, guy came to the studio and in 15 minutes he had a song. And I was, what was I going to do? I just let the guy sing and play. I was just astounded that he just, my name's Greg. I think it was Greg Barnhill. Great, great singer, songwriter. And he said, well, what are we working on? And we had a young artist with a sign to the company that we were looking for songs for. And stream of consciousness, the guy just started playing. And in 15 minutes, we had a song. I'd never experienced anything like that in my life. So Nashville really taught me a lot about the craft of writing a song. And I mean, I would have to say the only award show I can comfortably watch all the way through are the Country Music Awards, which I never liked country music when I was growing up. But they sing and they play and the lyrics are incredible. And I mean, to learn what country music, I have an appreciation for that and still working in EDM is quite a dichotomy.
Okay.
And I think what I try to do is to bridge all those together. I think music is constantly evolving. And I mean, there's been some collaborations with country and rap artists and Justin Bieber and Skrillex. It's people are in today's world, anything goes. You've got to broaden your horizons and everywhere. I guess people are always saying now, like you just asked me, what's next? Who knows? But at least that quest is still going on. What's next? You can only have a certain style of music last for so long because by nature, the public and even ourselves, we get bored with something. So just like you comping your guitar solo, you do it, I don't want to go do it again because you're bored because you listen to it and you comp the 27 takes the first time. So that's hard to go back in and have a newfound freshness for it. But I think that goes with the territory. The things are always evolving. And I think what's next is the next evolution of bridging whatever styles are hot and going by the wayside because they've been in the forefront for too long. And what's next is taking some of that and making the next thing. And I've always said, artists like Prince, who was a hero of mine, when Doves Cry with no bass on it, giving it to the record company and then saying, well, let us know when it's finished, and him saying, it's finished, dude. That once we put a bass on it, you can't be a chaser. You've got to believe in what you do and know that you have magic in it. And the naysayers who don't understand that will never get it, but you've got to believe that. When I was working with Metrophonic in the UK with the Sheer record, the story about, it was just when I had joined, but Mark Taylor who produced it, Auto-Tune had just come out and he was telling me the story. He was just playing around with it like we all do with a new piece of gear. And he just started messing around with her voice. And he said to me, geez, I don't know if I don't want to play it to her. She's going to think I think she sucks or whatever because I'm tuning her vocal. But to have the balls to play it to her, and this is a true story, she said once he did play it to her, she said, I love it. And they played it for Warner's, I forget the head of the label at the time, and he said, you can't do that. People are going to think you can't sing. And he said, over my fucking dead body, that record goes out like that or I'm off the label. So she had the, you know, he had the balls to play it to her. She had the vision to know that it was something cool and had some kind of magic to it. Never really been done. It was one of the first mainstream records. And yet you've got the head of the label traditionally going, oh, no, 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 can't do that. No, can't do that. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. What scares you about the music business?
There is no business. I think that scares me. You know, I used to get picked up in limos to go to mastering houses in Sterling in New York. And, you know, today, some of the singers I'm working with, you know, if you get a grand, you're lucky for something. And, you know, luckily I've done well with managing in the EDM world. But there is no business anymore. Going back to what I said about the amount of video games, I mean, my daughter will play Wii with her friends for hours and hours and maybe put on One Direction in the background or whatever. And, you know, she Andy Grammer, she's turned me on to a lot of good people that I just are really, really talented. But it just scares me that young people, and though I do come across very talented people, far and few between, I must say, because there's a lot of people who ask me to help them. And they really have nothing to offer, and they're just trying to hop on a bandwagon. I'll get on a plane somewhere, and there's five DJs and within the next 10 seats around me. You know, it's just shocking. So it just scares me that what's going to happen if, you know, somebody has to go work at McDonald's and doesn't have the time to sit in their basement and be a genius and come up with the next Imagine. You know, that scares me more than anything. And, you know, luckily, I do think there's some kind of evolution of that that seems to still be working. But how many times do you hear the state of the music today is mediocre and generic? And it is. It's mostly formula stuff. And you have to find your entertainment value within it. But the very, very, very few records. I remember the first time I saw Devo on TV. And, you know, and the first time I heard Eminem. My name is, you know, I remember those times. How much of that happens these days? You know, it's scary.
Doesn't happen enough, that's for sure.
Exactly. And it's a catch-22 because if you don't promote it enough and you don't allow in some way, it still has to be a struggle. If it's not a struggle, then the artist doesn't survive and the true talented artists don't rise to the top. So there has to be a balance of struggle and opportunity. And I think opportunity is going by the wayside. One of my favorite television shows today is The Voice. The singers are incredible. The guy Jordan just won is an amazing, amazing singer. It proves the theory of that show. But without the camaraderie and the chemistry of the judges, that wouldn't be on more than one season.
Yeah.
So,
right.
And how many, you know, how many of those artists have gone on to actually do anything from The Voice? Very few. You've got American Idol, which is just canceled, Kelly Clarkson, Daughtry, Carrie Underwood, you know, true artists. But even that now seems to be going by the wayside because it's only the success of the judges' camaraderie and banter that keeps The Voice alive. But there's some really good singers in that show. Really good.
Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you either learned along the way or you received from somebody?
That's a toughie. There's a balance of protecting yourself and trusting who you're working with. I find today a lot of people, they won't send an MP3 of a song that they want you to work on because they think you're going to steal it. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, you know, yes, you have to protect your interests. Publishing, like I said, I ran a company for a while, still has a value. But you've got to be able to trust and gamble, you know, especially today. You've got to pay your dues and you've got to be able to work for nothing. I still do shows for free with artists that get $20,000, $30,000, up to $50,000 a night sometimes. And I'll still do a show for free if it's the right business decision, if there's a value for it. And I think there's a younger culture where they're so concerned about getting screwed that nothing happens.
Yeah.
You know, one piece of advice I can guarantee anybody who's listening to this, if you don't do anything, nothing will happen. I can guarantee you that. So,
it's true though.
You know, it's a simple saying. It's a simple saying, but you know, you've got, and trust your instincts. I've always gone by that. At the end of the day, you can look in the mirror, you can sleep, and you'll learn from it and not do it again, or adapt the decision that you might have made hastily or whatever. So trust your instincts. Don't be afraid to just work and create something and be unique. In terms of business, you know, that's a whole different conversation. I don't think I could sum it up into one thing, but hopefully that's some kind of advice for people wanting to make music today.
That's great advice. Great advice. Well, this has been fun. I knew it would be.
Me too.
I
won't tell your listeners how long we've known each other.
Yeah, it's been a while, huh?
Can I just say that you have, whether you know it or not, been an inspiration and part of my career, because when I was at Berkeley and you were my teacher back then, and we had a production company, and you know, all part of that history. I have to say, Bobby Ozinski is a part of it.
Well, likewise. I go back and I think I was just thinking about Positive Productions the other day, which was our production company.
Yeah. I remember Phil Roy. I mean, I see him on Facebook and all the stuff that we did back then. It was really, really good. And you know, I very much value, I'll tell you what, anybody in the business who can have a friend for however many years we've known each other, that's a win. That is a win.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, that's one of the best parts about the business. When, you know, you get a friend and you have the friend for life, it's a gift.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
This is awesome. Thanks so much, Walt. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If anyone needs help in the EDM world, you can contact Walt via email or phone. You can get that info by going to his management company's website at spinoffmanagement.com. That's spin, S-P-I-N, off, O-F-F, management, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he helps put the show together. Many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.